your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Tuesday night, December 16th, 2025, as we record this episode. I'm finally back from the winter meetings plus vacation, where I went from 80 degrees in Miami on Sunday to negative 4-degree wind chill in Chicago. But spirits are high in Chicago right now. The Bears are good, and the White Sox have the number one overall pick. Nobody's got anything to complain about with Chicago sports, right? I'm kidding. But in this episode, I'm going to get caught up on what I missed from the last day at the winter meetings, including what it was like to be in the room when the White Sox won the MLB draft lottery. Plus, do the Rule 5 guys the White Sox have recently selected, do they have staying power in 2026? As in, can they stay on the roster all season, much like Shane Smith or Mike Vassell did in 2025? Or are their profiles a bit riskier? Also, we are 100 days away from opening day, so let's take a look at the projected White Sox 26-man roster is today, and guess what the next move will be from Chris Getz. We'll also take a look around Major League Baseball, as the free agent market has been moving steady since the winter meetings, including a recent run of veteran relievers. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And James and Jim, good to chat with you guys and, of course, hang out with you last week at the winter meetings in Orlando. But I missed the MLB draft lottery, as in my infinite wisdom, a year prior to the winter meetings, I booked a cruise that had to sail out of Miami on Wednesday, so I had to get myself from Orlando to Miami on Tuesday night. I also missed the Rule 5 draft, but not being in the room for the MLB draft lottery. So Jim Margulis, what was it like being in the room when history was made and the White Sox won the MLB draft lottery?
It was an interesting room. Like, you were at the last winter meetings in the room where it happened, the draft lottery. And you might remember that that room had the stage and then had a whole lot of room in front of the stage, like lots and lots and lots of rows of chairs. Like, it felt like a high school prom was booked also for that room and had a room to accommodate both. This was different in the sense that it was like the stage was aligned on like the narrow side of the room. So there wasn't a whole lot of room directly in front of the stage. The room for the media and other team members and such was off to the side, so they could all see the monitors. I was stationed like right in front of the stage between cameras, so I could not see the monitors. I was there to take photos. But I did notice, I had a hint or a hunch that the White Sox had good news, because I saw like Scott Reifert talking to some people, White Sox VP of communications, and like he stationed himself, like he just kept like walking further. Yeah, he's talking to people, and then like he like stationed himself on the other side of the cameras to take video. I was like, well, you might be documenting something important here. Like, I wasn't positive. Like, I was taking photos of every single draft slot from 7 to 1 just to have photos, like in case they drew fourth or something like that, that I would have photos of like Harold Baines next to the announcement of the fourth pick. But just had a sense like he's documenting this. Like, this feels important. This feels like he knows something. And sure enough, like, we found out soon after that Chris Getz comes walking across the stage. So he knew. And then we found out that like the Twins knew at 5 o'clock, or they knew if they had the first overall pick, they would know at 5 o'clock, a half hour before the draft, in order to sequester themselves. So, you know, there must have been enough people in the White Sox that knew something to where like people in the room must have known. So I was not shocked, but, you know, as somebody who runs a business contingent on White Sox interest, I was sweating it a little bit, just like, God, I hope that this is not a false flag. I hope this is not I'm staking myself to something here, because we really could use the traffic that the draft will bring. So, yeah, I was happy that the prophecy was true.
And everyone's still in good spirits, it sounds like, James, from the MLB draft lottery. I mean, Chris Getz was just recently on 670 The Score, and he's still excited. He's still hyped that they won the draft lottery.
Yeah, I feel like judging from the reactions in our comment section to like Getz's Wednesday availability, there was a lot of like, this guy sounds awful cocky, or like he's talking a lot about like, you know, the White Sox have so many things that are objectively going right that we can point to. Like, he was clearly just like still feeling extremely good as a result of that. Also, like, there was a funny question in the scrum right after the lottery where Bruce Levine, Yoji asked him, this is the first thing, good news, the White Sox have had since you took over. Which I think both like in terms of like a national headline or something, like I understood what he was talking about, but also for Chris's perspective, I commend him for mostly keeping a straight face, but a lot of his answers subsequently have been pointing out what he feels may have been overlooked in terms of good things that have happened for the White Sox since then.
So it stung. It resonated.
I think it was the like in terms of like them feeling like they were just basically, you know, no one looked like hungover or anything the next day, but like there was very much like a party mood for the final 36 hours of the winter meetings for them. And that was like the first, like, who invited this guy type of like moment of that. But yeah, I think, you know, some of the high fives Mike Shirley was giving right after the lottery, like you could probably hear for a couple of rooms over, like they were feeling good. They feel like this is like the, you know, I think a lot of watching this White Sox rebuild is like, all right, that's something need to be done, or all right, that looks like it's progressing fine, but like what is really here that makes this look like this is going to be special? Or you know, the talk about long-term vision usually gets like, hey, I think some of the people here are going to be the next team that competes for a division type of really measured optimism, and this is like this lightning bolt from above of like, well, maybe we'll just get a superstar handed to us and that will be the reason our rebuild succeeds more than others, which they needed something like that at some point, because it's there's not what makes this like operation special among 30 teams that are all trying to do similar things and maybe are spending more money towards it, you know, randomly getting handed Rock Chulowski. Maybe that's the thing.
I do wonder the presence of Rock Chulowski, like if this were last year's draft class and like the White Sox won the rights to draft Eli Willits, would the excitement been as high? Would the self-congratulations been so abundant if it were more of a wide open draft class and like they were saying like, hey, we have the chance to get a really good player somewhere in 1-1 versus like having at the very least like a preseason favorite? You know, it could change here and there between you know, big springs or injuries or whatnot, but at least at this point in the winter, having like somebody who should be good for it. And if anybody else crashes the party, so be it. But that was just one thing that stood out to me was, you know, this is probably the right draft class to be able to have this pick bounce your way, and then also use it for, you know, legitimate excitement when, you know, it's the winter meetings where you may not be doing all that much.
Well, last year was Ethan Holliday. We were there in Nashville when the White Sox, I guess, lost the draft lottery in quotes, where they were picking the top six, which disqualifies them for picking in the top 10. So everyone was lamenting the fact that they weren't going to be able to go after Ethan Holliday in 2025. That's what we would, if this was last year and the White Sox are the number one pick, we'd be debating between the college power hitter, Jace LaViolette, the right fielder in Texas A&M. White Sox right field issues have been saved. They're solved. Jace LaViolette's going to save the day. Or Ethan Holliday. And then, yeah, we saw what happened with LaViolette and Ethan Holliday. He ended up signing the biggest signing bonus in last year's draft, but he ended up going fourth overall to the Colorado Rockies. We got a long way to go. Like I mentioned in our previous episode, don't go to Grandstand and get your Rock Chulowski jersey made yet. You don't want to jinx yourself or Rock or the White Sox. Nobody wants to get hurt.
Also, what number?
That's a good question. That is a good question. But I can tell you, Sox Machine podcast listeners and subscribers, and thank you for your continued support, I will be in Arlington, Texas. I just got the press credential approved, so I will be reporting from February 27th through March 1st, that college baseball series, to get a firsthand look at Rock Chulowski against the SEC schools. So we'll have some first-person looks and videos and photos,
you can,
and hopefully a couple interviews
you can
well.
Play the role of Bruce Levine Yeah, just harshing his mellow by saying, so going from this to the White Sox, huh?
I don't want to do that. Aiden Teal, the younger brother of Kyle Teal, will also be playing in that tournament. So maybe we'll have to ask Aiden what big brother advice he's been getting from Kyle. But that's exciting. It was a lot of exciting stuff that happened in the winter meetings for the White Sox, with the MLB draft lottery being the biggest. But really, when you wipe away from that excitement, as you wrote on SoxMachine.com, James, and I thought you did a great job of recapping that, man, it feels like these winter meetings are pretty eventful for the White Sox, but they didn't do a whole lot. A week after the winter meetings, has anything really changed for the White Sox this offseason?
I mean, no. I feel like they could trade Luis Robert this winter. I'm sure they'd like that. But a lot of the talk like feels a little bit like a rerun. It's kind of the same teams that are in on them. And, you know, at least the Phillies are kind of posturing at their roster picture is set, with going with Justin Crawford in center field, who was kind of someone the White Sox wanted at earlier junctures. So, you know, the Garrett Crochet talks, like, Pittsburgh could still be in, but, you know, they did trade for the password and, you know, with some ideas of playing him in center field. So they have like an option they could go to if they want to upgrade in a big way and take on that salary. And the Padres are a contender and always do crazy stuff, but Robert's biggest hindrance is a price tag, and they're trying to shed salary. So, like, there is more activity around it, and there's talks about it because it's the winter meetings, the off season. It's December. It's when these conversations get revisited. But I'm at least not feeling like a ton of the ingredients have changed beyond like the last year and a half, where something hasn't happened, except like the market sucks. There's just not very many options, and then, you know, maybe someone will blink at some point. But, you know, even talking on the last day, or even rubbing shoulders with some sock people, like joking around, who are all in a good mood, they're all like, hey, you know, maybe something happened, but certainly nothing's in the works right now. And that was a week ago, and, you know, nothing's happened. So it's going to take like some sort of, the White Sox have been their stance of like trying to get impact back for Luis Robert for a while now. I don't think, and they shouldn't really just suddenly drop their price, because frankly, like, if the value is there, sure. But as far as figuring out the 2026 Robert roster, trading Robert causes more problems than it solves at this point, unless you're getting like a post-hype center fielder to replace your kind of also post-hype center fielder, just older. Yeah, like, they've done things. They won the lottery. They took two. I think they're the only team that had two selections in the major league phase of the Rule 5 draft.
Correct.
So they've, and their bullpen's pretty wide open still, even after that. So there's certainly, you know, activity, and the Anthony Kay became official, and, you know, the coaching staff announcement is coming on Wednesday by the time you're listening to this. So there's things happening, but as far as like their roster picture is still pretty open in terms of like, hey, who starts in right field, or who pitches the seventh inning, or is Jonathan Cannon really just kind of competing for a spot against not getting hurt, or is he competing against other people for the last rotation slot? There hasn't been a sea change in terms of that.
Got it. And that's why, you know, this podcast episode, as I mentioned in the intro, we are 100 days away from opening day. So this is a good time to kind of look at the White Sox 26-man roster and see the work that still needs to be done by Chris Schatz. In one way, you could look at it and say there's still plenty of time. But in the other, and we'll touch on this when we get to around MLB, the market has been moving pretty steady. So let's recap what the White Sox have done before taking a look at what we think the White Sox could do in the near future. And Jim, that's the Rule 5 draft, guys. So one American pronunciation is Jedickson. I think, chatting with James before you started recording this episode, it's Jedickson Paez. So hopefully we get clarification. Please do not kill me on the pronunciation. I hope he shortens it up. It just goes by Jedi, as the Star Wars fan in me. And you also have right-handed pitcher Alexander Alberto. So Paez coming from Boston, Alberto coming from Tampa Bay. Both of these guys in pitching Double A last year. And Paez barely pitched in 2025. These profiles are a lot different than Shane Smith and Mike Vassell last year, even though when the Phillies did take Tampa Bay took Vassell in the Rule 5 draft, Vassell had some work. Shane Smith also had some work with the Milwaukee Brewers. So we could at least get some idea of what kind of workload they can contribute to the White Sox as we entered that spring training last year. With Paez and Alberto, Jim, these profiles are risky. Do they have staying power? Could they really stay with the White Sox all season? Or at some point, is Chris Getz going to have to return them back to the respective organizations?
Josh, what if I told you that Hendickson, whatever his name is, we'll find out, Paez, his birthday was May 4th.
Shut up. He's got to go by 17th. Jedi. He's got to go 17th. By Jedi.
January 17th. Oh. It's not May 4th.
Hold on. Let me throw this rubber band at the camera. Boo, Jim.
Yeah.
Boo.
I like that one. It does feel like the White Sox have a hunch about one of these two guys. It more feels like either a heat check or we have a lot of guys who fit like the one inning role that like Peyton Pollett got drafted for by Cleveland. Or, you know, we have maybe some spot starters who can maybe go 4 or 5, but can they go beyond that? Maybe not so much. So I think they're looking for either, you know, in the case of Alberto, leverage of just here's a 6'8" guy who hits triple digits. And if we can teach him one weird trick to get him through 90 days of active time next year, then we'll have somebody that we currently don't have in our organization. Paez, I think, was more confusing to me in terms of just being more of a control maven who hasn't pitched a double A. Like, that's a long way to go. A lot of road to close over those last three levels as somebody whose fastball is low 90s. So I think of the two, like I might think Alberto just might be the one guy who, if he can, you know, if the control gains that he made last year hang around and he's able to just kind of use brute force to work his way through low and medium leverage innings once in a while, like he stands a better chance of sticking, I think. And maybe with like a strategically timed injured list stint mixed in to kind of give him a breather here and there, feels like he has the better chance of sticking than Paez. So like when they drafted twice, it made more sense to me, like, okay, drafting two of these guys makes more sense than just drafting Paez and then calling it a Rule 5 draft. But I don't necessarily have high hopes for either. Smith was, you know, somebody at AAA experience, Shane Smith last year, had multi-inning experience and could be used as a starter if they continued down that path. So multiple ways to make him work. It really seems like in this case, there's only one way for them to survive the season, and that's just the traditional one inning or like hope that you have a lot of low leverage, long relief outings where two innings of bad relief will still be useful. Kind of like the Dylan Covey model of just, and he's another guy who needed an IL stint to, you know, get through his 90 days, but every one of those 90 days was felt. I think that this is a case here where it will be a long season. And if they make it out of spring training, or if they don't make it out of spring training, I won't be surprised.
James, what should we know, or I guess what should I know about Paez and Alberto as far as their stuff? What are the White Sox getting here?
Paez is like this extreme control guy. They're very much like complementary, I guess, or you know, opposite skill sets. Paez is like a little dude. He's 6'1". He looks kind of skinny, but I don't see like a ton of projection. Like he's going to throw a lot harder. He's been like 90, 94. At some points he's already like throwing like 30% fastballs or less, or throwing more sliders. He's kind of like pitches like he's 36, but it's like a little guy in A ball. Like you'll see him,
a Matt Selesky,
throw a slide. If he throws a slider that's like doesn't get a chase, it's just off, he'll then like hit you with a cutter that does stay and hit next to corner. Like these sort of like old man sequencing trips that like you can only do if you have really good control. I think probably the appeal to the White Sox is that if he's healthy, he had a calf injury in April, basically misses 4 months. He comes back and pitches in August, looks like pretty good, like himself again. And you think if he has a full year, especially since he had gotten to high A the previous year, that he probably gets a double A and puts himself not knowing the Red Sox 40-man picture at the back of my hand, but it was like a lot more consideration for 40-man protection if he doesn't miss the season. So your White Sox, you're saying, and you know, the Fangraphs was like borderline top 100 on him coming into the year. It was a weird year a little bit before that because his release point had changed pretty significantly. It's a lot higher, and his slider wasn't working as well because of that. He can deal with it a little bit because he has 5-6 other pitches. He also seems very much like a Zach Bove type of guy where he's going to have like two different fastballs. He already throws a sinker and a four seamer. The four seamer doesn't have action other than like you've been looking at 5 different variations of down or down sinking away. And then he rides one up there and you miss it just because like you're not looking at there at all. He is kind of safer than you would think for someone who's skipping so many levels. As safe as a Rule 5 guy can be, he's just not maybe as big an upside. So I think like you're kind of hoping like it'd be great if he had a Mike Vassell like season. I mean, that's true for any Rule 5 guy, but in terms of like, oh, he gives us multiple innings, he comes and he throws strikes, I think the downside of him is him getting like hit really hard.
Okay.
Whereas Alberto, he picked up 2 ticks last season at velocity. So now he sits 98 and he's touched 101. He has like a huge slider that has like a 60% miss rate. He also can barely ever throw it for a strike. He's 6'8". Like his delivery just looks like he's too big. Like everything just looks funny for him a lot. Like he falls over the first base side. He'll eat it on occasion and fall on the mound. Sometimes when he's dipping into his leg so much, it kind of looks like he could just sit down on the mound because like it's this preposterously long torso and these legs that have like bent really far. But it's very threadbare control. It got a little bit better last year. Like his walk rates weren't bad, but he was also like a 23-year-old pitching in A-ball. And he like spent 3 years in the complex league where it was just like, you know, Thiago Vieira level of like messiness. And it's got a little bit better and he's using a cutter a bit more. They talked about like it being Emmanuel Clase light with his cutter. I don't know about that. It's more like his fastball is 99. His cutter is like 95 and it gives him a little bit something like, right now, his fastball is the only thing he can consistently throw for a strike, and his cutter is kind of in the middle of that between that and the wipeout slider. It's a much more traditional Rule 5 guy of like, wow, huge stuff. If we get him, if we can tweak something to make him throw strikes at all, like he can get by in the bullpen. Like with someone with this who throws 101 who has like huge miss rates on a slider, can technically you can see them pitching high leverage down the road, but like it seems so far from that in terms of like strike throwing that. I think you're more like hoping you get him through the year and maybe work him. It's still more of a long-term development project. Like I could see him being awesome in his late 20s because he's 6'8" and throws super hard, but it's been a really long journey to throw even this level of strikes, which I think is still pretty borderline for sticking on a roster. So I think he's the more traditional risky Rule 5 pick. It's just a shorter road to go. Like we've seen guys get by in single inning relievers with a 5 walk per 9 and you'd probably call that a success for Alberto at this stage, whereas like Paez is a bit newer version of Rule 5. Like we think this guy is going to throw like 80 to 100 innings of relief, which wasn't really a job you had maybe 5-8 years ago in a major league bullpen where it was all just like stuff and, you know, try to get all your leverage works, but now all starts have been so short that you kind of need like this meta starter in the bullpen a little bit to soak up innings a little bit. So Paez, I think, is the better talent in terms of like he could, there's a lot more easier route to him being like a 2 WAR pitcher, even if he doesn't get like super good just because he can throw lots of innings because he throws so many strikes. But they both have their reasons why I could go awry the Rule 5 picks. If anything, I wonder like what do you add to Paez? Is it like, you know, 6th and 7th pitch? Like it's not as clear as like, hey, this is a profile that just misses a changeup entirely. His changeup might be his best pitch because he commands it so well. And Alberto, like, I don't know, they've had success obviously with pitching dev. I wouldn't say that like guy who throws 100 but can't hit the side of a barn, but now he taught him to throw strikes is like the specific fix we've seen them pull off over the last 2 years. That's more of like the Matt Thornton one bullpen session with Don Cooper type of legend stuff where you saw them just, or on the other side of it, Andy Cisco of let's just get a power arm and we'll teach him to throw strikes. I don't know if we've seen like that specific project click so far, if only because like pitch dev has gotten so good that like if you're getting to the majors and you can't throw strikes, maybe you just can't throw strikes at this stage in pitching development. So I'm more curious, like, what do they see as like the tweaks here? Because it obviously, like Smith, it happened so quickly that he was already pretty good at the changeup they wanted to throw by the time he arrived in spring training. I'd love to hear like what Bannister wants to say. Maybe I've even put in a request to PR about what Bannister has to say about these two guys. Who knows? Because what they're currently at seems like a step away from what they need to be to really stick. So I want to see what the White Sox vision of that step is.
Alberto's listed weight, his listed height is 6'8". His listed weight is 203. For comparison, Prelander Baroa, one row down from him, alphabetical order, 5'11", 215.
Look, watching the video, I would bet he is over 203 by now by a good margin. But I don't think that those numbers are going to steer you wrong for what it looks like.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to when players report a spring training, especially for like ABS purposes, and their heights get revised. I'm curious if the weights go along with it and that listing changes. But yeah, because watching, you know, like Wickelman Gonzalez, he's listed 6'2", 220, and he's like a beefy 6 foot. Bro is doesn't strike me as like a beefy guy. Like he's built, but he's not like like a fire plug or anything like that.
So he's short is the issue.
Yeah, sure. But like in terms of like, yeah, just it's muscle weighs more than fat, I guess, in Baroa's case. But you know, Alberto, him outweighing Alberto despite a 9-inch deficit, right, is pretty remarkable.
Anderson Comas, before he became the first openly gay professional baseball player, or one of the first, he was 6'7" always. So he was the resident guy in spring training you see walking across like the field, like, whoa, look at that guy. If they got him to do something, that'd be amazing. So I think Alberto will fill that role as this really long, slender man type build with a pitching glove.
So it's December. We'll learn more about these guys in the near future, as James already hinted at. This is one of the assignments that he's given himself that he wants to cover and get more insight from Brian Bannister. So that sounds like a future article coming on SoxMachine.com. Great time to plug being a subscriber to Sox Machine. Again, the Defector promo is still going on. Mm-hmm. We're getting closer to New Year's. So you sign up for that annual membership with Sox Machine. Takes care of all of 2026 for you. So great time to sign up and get that exclusive content to learn more about Paez and Alberto. But hearing both of you chime in about these Rule 5 picks, to me it seems like they're the 7th and 8th guy on Will Venable's projected bullpen right now in 2026, and we'll see them early if it's like the White Sox are down more than 4 runs and the game's entering the 7th inning. All right, Alberto. All right, Paez. Let's see what you got. I mean, we're already down by 5, so it's really up to the offense to decide if we're going to be back in this game or not, but what a great time to see what you've got. Like, is that what we're kind of foreseeing here for both as far as their playing time early in 2026?
I mean, I think they'll be eased in, you'd imagine. Like, opening day, that's probably perception. Like, Alberto, like, he could be, pitching the 8th in September. He might, start the season in Double-A Montgomery after he didn't throw enough strikes in camp. Like the range of outcomes for him are pretty wide. Whereas I would imagine Paez, just with like his starting potential, they probably would like try to, and him being, the second overall pick in the Rule 5 draft, that they would try to carry him through just so they can develop him as a starter long-term, even if like this project kind of goes off the rails in some way. I imagine it gets a little bit longer rope, but maybe starting out the way Vassell did. Granted, Vassell was like saving games by May, but I would think his strike throwing would give him a little bit more utility of what to do, whereas like Alberto, if it's pretty rough and we're just trying to get through it, especially in April, be like, yeah, let's we're down 10-0, go out there and give it a whirl.
Paez feels like the kind of guy who can like throw 2 innings. You might give up like 4 runs, but it'll be like over 30 pitches. Like, it seems like he'll be efficient getting beat. I think Alberto, like the problem with him is if it doesn't work, like he's somebody who throws like 7 of 30 pitches for strikes when they're down 8 runs in the fourth inning. And then like Venable has to get a guy warming up in the bullpen, you know, before that inning is over. So I think that's why like Paez, depending on like what the rest of the bullpen looks like, and they still have to fill that out. If there's like a yawning gap in like their multi-inning arms, then I could see Paez fitting. If it's a case where like they have Vassell, you know, see who else they bring in, but they have guys who can throw multiple innings and you're really just looking for any kind of velocity, which they've missed in previous years, or any kind of ability to miss bats, then you might see a little bit more, you know, rope for Alberto, just to see like it, see if his stuff works because major leaguers. If it doesn't, then we'll return you in April versus, you know, versus March. But yeah, it does feel, you know, I would say like the bust rate for Alberto is probably higher versus Paez. Probably can get by either faking it or just like wearing a 6 ERA, but in a way that like still helps because he's able to throw 2 innings.
Yeah, like a bad like Paez outing is like Venable saying like, I like the way he came back and was really just pumping strikes after the back-to-back homers, whereas like a bad Alberto outing is like, you don't want to have to warm up somebody in 8-1 game in the ninth inning, but it was just the responsible thing to do. Whereas, you know, a good Paez thing is maybe make starts this year, and you know, maybe Alberto like just wipes out right-handers with his slider so much that he, you know, can handle some leverage. So, who knows?
Again, risky though. Like these are not like lockdown guys that we are all expecting the White Sox to add to the bullpen. It's creative. Like I give the White Sox credit here. It's a creative way to address the bullpen, to give a couple guys and other organizations that didn't pitch in Double A last year and see what they got. Because I like the scouting reports that you both gave for Paez and Alberto. So I'm intrigued in what the stuff looks like, and I can't wait to see what they do during spring training. But these are not veteran arms. And again, we are now within 100 days of opening day. The White Sox did add left-handed pitcher Ryan Rollison to the 40-man roster, a former first-round pick out of Ole Miss way back in the 2018 MLB draft. I actually did write up a profile about Rollison when we rebooted Sox Machine in that first year. So we have Rollison content all the way back in 2018. But the 40-man roster is currently at 38 for the Chicago White Sox. But when you look at the 26-man roster, there's still a lot of holes remaining. As James mentioned, not much has been moving on that front for the White Sox. Really, the only substantial move the White Sox have made this offseason is signing Anthony Kaye to add him to the starting rotation. So, Jim, let's guess here. There's still a lot of work to be done in the offseason for the White Sox. What do you think their next move is?
I guess I said reliever before, right? When we were talking about like the most...
Yes. We were trying to make a guess.
Most plausible winter meetings move. So yeah. I guess I'll still say that. Like there is a possibility like Ryan O'Hearn is still out there. White Sox could use like a good, you know, real sturdy first base option with a little bit of flexibility. They like him. So like theoretically he'd be somebody who's talented enough to decide when he wants to sign. And so he could move faster than like a more amorphous relief market. But I still think like given just the amount of arms they need to consider or not amount of spots they need to consider and arms that might interest them, that I think, yeah, just mathematically speaking, I would say relief is still probably the most likely field.
All right, James, how about you? If you had to guess, I'm not asking you to make a prediction, but if you had to guess, what's the next offseason move for the White Sox?
Signing a left-handed corner outfielder. I don't know. Something generic that maybe even something familiar that looks like it needs a platoon partner, but
are you talking about Mike Tauchman? Are you talking about
His name
Tauchman
rhymes
returning?
With Tyke Mockman.
There's that possibility, or just something that kind of fits that mold, I suppose.
Oh, okay. All right. Now I like the Ryan O'Hearn idea. If the White Sox were to sign O'Hearn, man, that would spark a great conversation of what the hell are you doing with Lenin Sosa? I recently saw on social media some people want to give Sosa a shot in the outfield. I chuckle at that idea.
I don't think like making him run longer distances is going to make him seem faster
or better defensively.
But that's just me. I think like his hands is probably his best defensive attribute.
Well, it's kind of like when Eloy played left, like he was better on tough catches because like he just knew what direction he had to start running immediately. So like if it was a ball like deep in the alley, you knew like I need to go in that direction. I can sort it out later in terms of like the more precise angle, but you know, he would react quickly enough to where like the speed that he had, which was not terrible before all the injuries, like he could cover a surprising amount of ground. It was like when there was more information to parse in terms of like infielders or Luis Robert or foul line or, you know, just, you know, directly over his head or directly in front of him. That's when like the reads became slower and the plays became clumsier. So I do wonder like if Soso had the same thing to where like if the action just tells him like you need to go this direction now, if you would actually smooth out versus like the more complicated plays at second that involve like, you know, angling your body and getting, you know, taking the right angle to get deep enough to be able to be in position to throw, you know, that sort of thing that, you know, where, you know, maybe the amount of finer motor skills involved slowed him down.
Well, we'll
that's
see
my sales pitch for Lenin Sosa outfielder is Eloy Jimenez's better days, which are okay. Few and far between.
Well, you had the sales pitch for Lenin at first. We got to see that. So
sorry.
Maybe
I apologize.
Sorry, apologize. Maybe we do get to see Lenin in the outfield, but that's only if the White Sox did sign someone like Ryan O'Hearn, which I haven't heard the latest gossip if O'Hearn is close to signing. Some of my other offseason plan project targets, Mike Yastrzemski signed with Atlanta. On the starting pitching front, Dustin May went to St. Louis, which is interesting, with them being rebuilding, but I guess he's also trying to rebuild as far as his profile. So I think I'm out of ideas now on the starting pitching front and the outfield help for my offseason plan project. But we're still waiting for that starting pitching, especially the top end of the starting pitching market, to shake out. But this leads to around Major League Baseball and to your point, Jim, about the reliever market. If the White Sox do want to add a veteran reliever, they might want to do so sooner than later. The market has been really steady in free agent signing. As far as news, it seems like every single day since the winter meetings, there really hasn't been a lull of activity since Orlando. And Bob Nightingale on Twitter from USA Today summed it up pretty nicely. Even just from Tuesday, December 16th, the following veteran relievers all signed. The Angels signed Jordan Romano and Drew Pomeranz. Chris Martin's returning to the Texas Rangers. Caleb Ferguson's going to Cincinnati. Caleb Theobar's going back to the Chicago Cubs. And Jason Foley's going to the San Francisco Giants. None of these guys, I would say, are big impact relievers. A lot of them are on the older side, but they're definitely in the wheelhouse as far as money that the White Sox would be able to spend, and they're going elsewhere. So, Jim, I guess I have to pose this question because this is one that's kind of on my mind, and as I get back into work mode since vacation mode, are you a bit surprised that the White Sox haven't been more active on the veteran reliever market so far this offseason? Because these are not big names and they're not signing big dollars, but doesn't really feel like the White Sox have been in on these guys. And I could be wrong, and maybe they were, and these guys decided to sign elsewhere outside of the White Sox. But are you surprised that they haven't signed a veteran reliever?
Not necessarily like the Pete Fairbanks rumor, and he hasn't signed yet. You know, Scott Merkin reported that the White Sox were interested in Pete Fairbanks, and I think he's more than like the relievers cited. I think he's a name brand reliever, you know, maybe post peak, but still, you know, somebody who's handled high leverage for good teams. To me, that strikes me as more like the market the White Sox might be interested in, just to give Will Venable somebody who can anchor a bullpen or is at least used to anchoring a bullpen versus, you know, a whole bunch of guys who might have to be shielded from closer like expectations. But I was looking at the offseason plan project. I've been going through the free agents suggested. And over the course of 51 plans, there were 35 free agent relievers mentioned. And looking at the 15 that were mentioned more than twice, and it looks like the only ones available. So Devin Williams signed, Gregory Soto signed, Caleb Ferguson signed, Hobie Milner signed. You have Jalen Beeks and Andrew Chafin among lefties would be the ones that have not signed yet. And then on the righties, you have, you know, Fairbanks, Hunter Harvey, Luke Weaver. You have some like options there that in terms of like they've pitched for good teams, they're still out in the market.
Yeah.
One of those guys,
Harvey,
I feel,
my offseason plan.
Yeah. So I think that's one where like those kind of level of signings make more sense to hop on, you know, at this stage in the winter for the White Sox versus, you know, the ones who are signing now or just seem like kind of the safer options for teams with more aspirations, just kind of filling out a bullpen. They don't want to be missing out on having a weak link, you know, in their seventh inning plans. Whereas the White Sox, I think, are maybe shopping for one guy and then maybe more for volume or for innings or for, you know, the low-cost banister hunches, I suppose, to fill out the rest of the bullpen.
Got it. No, that makes sense. James, are you surprised at all as far as the White Sox not being, I guess...
Oh, Michael Kopech also had two votes or two suggestions.
Could a reunion be in the mix? Does Kopech want to come back?
I put on my Belford Again award hat on a lot with the White Sox, but it's not... surprised that they are not more active in free agency. That one, eventually you got to respond to training. No, I'm not surprised, but they're also like, it'd be shocking if they signed more than like two relievers to guarantee major league deals. I don't think there's like this horrendous like scarcity for what they're implying to do. And they're not like, you know, stated like we're going to go to get a top of market closer or have that expectation where it's like when Edwin Diaz went off the board or Kevin Williams, like, oh, sure. God, where are they going to go? Like, so it's December 16th. There's a lot of time for them to be active. And, you know, maybe in terms of finding someone who's done high leverage before, maybe the White Sox a little bit representing your market, not developing how you expected. And that's where they pounce. So I think there's a lot of possibilities open without being like, man, why haven't they done anything yet?
Sure. If they were to get both Ryan O'Hearn and Peter Fairbanks, that would be an interesting offseason. Like, low-key, I would like those additions, but if they only signed Peter Fairbanks, and that's it, and that was like, that's our offseason, Anthony Kay and Peter Fairbanks, a couple of Rule 5 guys, and we're going to trot out this outfield with Everson Pereira and Derek Hill... and still entertain trade rumors for Luis Robert. I don't know about that.
Can't imagine them doing that. I think a lot of their emphasis has been about in kind of accepting their lot in life a little bit in terms of what they can shop for. I think that the teams they're trying to build are ones that don't have holes and have adequate depth everywhere rather than like, let's put diamond encrusted rims on our, you know, 84 geo type of roster building or stars and scrubs style. So I can't imagine them signing a big time closer and doing nothing out the outfield. I don't think that even just lines up with their philosophy about roster building with where they're at.
James, geo didn't exist until 1989.
Neither the diamond encrusted rims back then, but
Jim just shooting everything down this episode. Well, we'll see what the White Sox
have
do next.
Toyota Tercel on Dubs is what I'm saying.
Oh, we'll see what the White Sox do next. Let us know in the comment section if you guys have a prediction what the White Sox do. But the last note, and this is a pretty significant one for those that have season ticket plans or those that are beat reporters. For the White Sox, no 7-10 starts for the Chicago White Sox in 2026, the latest start time the White Sox will have for a home game. I should have specified, no home 7-10 starts for the White Sox in 2026. 6:40, Jim Margulis, 6:40 is now the new start time for home games for the White Sox, along with the 6-10s, sometimes at 3:10s, and then of course the getaway days or random Saturdays, 1:10 starts.
It reminds me of my favorite band, The Hold Steady. They played a four-night set in New York City every year at Brooklyn Bowl. And this year, I think the show started at 8:30 and there was no opener. And they said that reflected their the state of their fan base. Like, we need to go home at a reasonable hour. And I think that's what my first read of the situation was, like, oh, everybody has to get to work tomorrow. Everybody has sleep schedules to worry about, and that's really more important here. But as somebody who watches basically all the games on TV, like, great for me. As fans, and this could be a case too where, like, if they're not counting on huge attendance, perhaps you do prioritize more reasonable hours for everybody else, or better TV windows, ratings throughout the entirety of the nine innings versus people tuning out early. So I'm curious, like, if this is a product of a team that's lost 100 games 3 years in a row and doesn't figure to get better, like, immediately, or if this is just trends of just, this is where they feel like the bang for the buck is, and the poor saps who are trying to, like, get to the park from Arlington Heights or something like that across town are just more like, either they get there at the second inning or leave earlier, or just they are not not the target fan.
I wonder, and I'll ask Brooks Boyer this during food day in March. I wonder if this is something they got back from customer surveys, because the White Sox did send out a lot of surveys to season ticket holders throughout the year. I that's my first inclination of why the White Sox don't have any 7:10 starts. I could see if there was, like, fans saying that, hey, we enjoy the 6:10 or the 6:40 starts because I don't want to get home at 10, 10:30 or 11 o'clock after a Tuesday night game. I could see them making this decision based on customer surveys, which, there you go. That's an example. The White Sox do listen to their paying customers. But opening day again will be Thursday, April 2nd, that's the target date. Friday, April 3rd is an off day in case if it snows or rains out. The home opener against the Toronto Blue Jays, they could move that game back to Friday. But right now, April 2nd is the home opener against the Blue Jays at 3:10 p.m. Central Time. And then that Saturday game, April 4th, will be 1:10. The White Sox first night game will be on Monday night, April 6th, against the Baltimore Orioles. And for those that are interested in the Crosstown Classic between the White Sox and the Chicago Cubs, Friday night, May 15th, 6:40. Saturday night, May 16th at 6:10. So both of the marquee games between the White Sox and Cubs in that weekend will be night games, not day games. And we'll still look at the road times as well, and we'll report on that when the White Sox have their complete schedule. But we do have home times now, and we can include that in the podcast page on SoxMachine.com so you guys can check it out and make your plans. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the podcast, you could subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen to the show and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James Fegan at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. We are on Blue Sky at SoxMachine.com. James is JRFegan.SoxMachine.com. And I am Josh.SoxMachine.com. I already plugged becoming a Sox Machine subscriber, but you can do so still at SoxMachine.com/products, where monthly plans start at $5. And hey, the holidays are coming up. We're in the middle of Hanukkah right now. Christmas is coming up. If you're running out of gift ideas, or you just need, like, a digital stocking stuffer, give your favorite White Sox fan a Sox Machine subscription. Again, you get a discount on annual memberships. Go to SoxMachine.com/products to sign up today. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your own for all things Chicago White Sox baseball, and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.